You guys know I'm crazy about Audible because it offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. Audible really is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment, with female writers and heroines, celebrity narration, multicast productions with immersive sound design, and traditional audiobooks. Audible has you covered for any type of excitement that you're looking for. In fact, right now I'm listening to The Second Husband by Kate White. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. That's audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. With four daughters and two on a dance team, I can tell you we go through a lot of mascara in my house. But I'm crazy about L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, which catches every lash from corner to corner for maximum volume. If you're looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank, this is yours. The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. I've been using it for about 2 weeks now, and I feel like my eye has completely opened up, and the girls are crazy about it too. They've got a tapered brush to catch every lash, one of the best mascara wands that I've ever used. And like I said, this luxe appearance of this gold package, you got to get it. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today. L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, you're going to love it. Welcome back to another episode of Reality Life with Kate Casey. I'm hoping that you had a great weekend. I was at a bookstore this weekend and came across a book called The Only Plane in the Sky by Garrett Graff, an award-winning journalist and best-selling historian. The book is an oral history of September 11th, 2001. Like most people, that day I cannot soon forget. It has left an indelible mark in my life. At the time I lived in Virginia Beach, I was with somebody in the military who had been abroad at the moment, and my older sister was working at World Trade Center 7 in New York City. I spent the majority of the day trying to find her, and it wasn't until late into the evening I even knew that she was alive. It was a terrifying, terrifying experience. And to add to that, one of my dear friends from college, Joe Healy, was one of the first responders to the Pentagon. A majority of my friends from college still lived in D.C. at the time. Several of them worked in government positions. And as I mentioned, I lived in Virginia Beach. And the strange thing was, the day after September 11th, they started showing pictures of the hijackers. And I immediately realized that I recognized one of them, Muhammad Atta, who was one of the lead hijackers, because he had been using a mail depot across the street from my neighborhood. And I called the FBI and reported it. And about 6 months afterwards, there was some footage on the news and reports that had said that Atta and another hijacker had spent time in Virginia Beach casing the military bases. And in the process, after I read this book and tracking down Garrett Graff, I found out that the mail depot place had been a spot that the two hijackers had used to send things back to and from their counterparts, which is just so eerie. And I just felt like this book was so interesting because there are so few accounts of just the people that were involved in all aspects of that day. Of course, we can find accounts from President Bush and from Vice President Cheney, but to hear the stories of the people that were living and working in the city at the time, people who were in the buildings, people who had loved ones in the buildings, the conversations that they had, and all the stories that are rarely told about that day were so interesting and so well told in Garrett's book. So I wanted to reach out to him and kind of ask him about how the book came about, the interesting things that came about in the process of researching it, and what we can really learn 18 years past that moment of, you know, how the world has changed since then and how the incident would have been different in this new modern tech era, because we forget how cell phones were so much different than now. I mean, people now take video of almost everything, and there is so few footage of the planes not only going into the buildings, there's no footage of the plane going into the Pentagon, only still photos. So it's just a strange, strange thing to think about in retrospect. So I really want you to think about getting this book. I think that it's a great book if you have children. It's a great book just to go back and to read. And it, despite the fact that it's one of the most horrific days that we can all remember, there is so much hope that's within the book. Stories about triumph of spirit, of community, and to also remember how we felt that day. Like, despite the despair and the worry, that there was hope for the world and a real sense of community and a coming togetherness that I hope that we can all find once again. And then I also watched this Netflix series during the break called Don't F with Cats, Hunting an Internet Killer. And I wanted to go back and interview Boston homicide detective author Brian Dunford, who's been on the show before, and ask him what he thought about the series. So this episode highlights two great authors. Listen, podcasts are fantastic, but I also don't want you to forget about just how fantastic books are. And so I'm really hopeful that you'll go out and get these two books and honor these two prolific writers and the great work that they do. So this episode is the oral history of 9/11 author Garrett Graff and a review of Don't F with Cats with Boston homicide detective author Brian Dunford. So here we go. The Only Plane in the Sky has been spectacularly written by award-winning journalist and best-selling historian Garrett Graff. It tells the story of 9/11, drawing on never-before-published transcripts, recently declassified documents, original interviews, and oral histories from nearly 500 government officials, first responders, witnesses, survivors, friends, and family members. He paints the most vivid and human portrait of the September 11 attacks to date. I'm thrilled to tell you I have tracked him down. Garrett, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
I have to first tell you, you have done such a terrific job with this book. It is obviously a very difficult moment in history, but I really appreciated how you brought so many people's lives, those that lived through the experience and those that we've lost, through the book. And it's like getting a better sense of some of the people that we lost. So I really just appreciate the hard work that you put into it. Maybe if you could just start by telling us a little bit about the genesis of the book, because as I understand it, you wrote an article that went viral for Politico magazine about the experience of those aboard Air Force One on September 11th, and it was the most downloaded article in Politico's history.
Exactly. So I wrote a piece for the 15th anniversary of 9/11 in 2016, called The Only Plane in the Sky, that was an oral history of those who were aboard Air Force One with the president on 9/11. Those listeners who remember, President Bush was in Sarasota, Florida on 9/11, reading to school kids at Emma Booker Elementary School, and he was rushed aboard Air Force One in the minutes after the second attack. And what the article did was sort of trace the next 8 hours of the president's day as he was hidden aboard Air Force One, high above the skies in Florida and in the Gulf of Mexico. Ultimately, they sent him to Barksdale Air Force Base in Shreveport, Louisiana, and then on to Offutt Air Force Base in just outside Omaha, Nebraska. And it wasn't until late afternoon, when all the other planes had been grounded in the United States, that the Secret Service deemed it safe for him to return to Washington. And so the title of the piece grew out of the idea that as the president was flying back to Washington at the end of 9/11, he was, in effect, the only plane in the sky above North America. And as you said, the article, when it published, very quickly became the most read piece in the history of Politico. And it inspired me to try to expand that, because what I heard from readers who read that first piece, I got sort of two reactions that really stuck with me. I mean, I heard from hundreds of readers, and there were just these two that sort of kept rattling around my mind in the months after that original piece published. One was a mother, a veteran, who had two children, 7 and 9 years old then. And she wrote to say that she had printed out my article and set it aside so that when her children were old enough to read it and talk about it, she would be able to help explain to them why Bommie had left them to go off to war. And there was another veteran who wrote me, a younger guy, Army, and he had been in middle school on 9/11, and he had done 3 tours, 2 in Afghanistan, 1 in Iraq since 9/11. And he wrote me to say that he had never really understood the trauma of that day until he had seen my article and sort of seen the day through President Bush's eyes. And those two reactions really made me realize how, you know, this year now we are 18 years removed from 9/11. And we're beginning to hand off a world created and shaped by 9/11 to a generation who just don't understand it, who have no emotional connection to it, were too young to remember it. You know, a quarter of the U.S. population today now is either too young to remember 9/11 or was born after it. Wow. And you know, the world that they are inheriting is one where sort of every bit of their daily life in many ways is being shaped by the decisions that were made in the wake of 9/11. And I just sort of couldn't imagine, you know, what it must be like to be someone who is sort of growing up in this world today and yet doesn't know what 9/11 was like. And so the goal of this book, which, as you sort of laid out in your introduction, takes people just chronologically through the day, just beginning on the morning of 9/11 and ending at the end of that night, it is to tell 9/11 in the words of those who experienced it. So it's all oral history. It's all people's own words, 500 people coast to coast, morning to night. And I think it's important to try to tell the story in that way, because one of the things that comes out when you go back to the way that people lived that day is, and you know, you remember this day as well, is the story that we tell about 9/11 when we try to explain 9/11, when we read about 9/11 in history books, is not the day that any of us actually lived. You know, we tell this sort of much neater and cleaner and simpler history of that day, that the attacks began at 8:46 in the morning and ended at 10:29 with the collapse of the second tower, that there were 4 flights, that there were the 4 attacks, the Pentagon, Shanksville, and the World Trade Center. But the thing is, that's not what any of us knew at the time, and that's not what any of us lived at the time. And, you know, we did not know we didn't know when the attacks began. We didn't know what happened as they unfolded, and we didn't know when the attacks were over, and we didn't know what came next. And sort of trying to remember all of that, remember that chaos, that confusion, the fear, the trauma of that day, I think is really important in trying to understand why our nation reacted to 9/11 in the way that it did.
You begin with the most interesting account from the only American that was off the planet. Can you tell everyone a little bit about the perspective of the astronaut who was able to see overhead what had transpired?
Yeah, and this was one of the most remarkable memories of that day, really, that I came across as I was working on this, was Frank Culberson, who was the only American off of planet Earth on 9/11. And he was aboard the International Space Station and woke up that morning and sort of called down to mission control and said, you know, how's the day on planet Earth? And they said, we're actually not having a great day down here on planet Earth. And he realized pretty quickly that they were about to, in their orbit, come over New York City. And that he was able to actually look out the window of the International Space Station and see the smoke plume coming off of Lower Manhattan. And that he actually saw the dust cloud from the collapse of the Trade Center. And that as the day unfolded, he was able to sort of see the gash in the Pentagon from the sky, and that he was ultimately able to sort of watch the disappearance of the flight contrails as the airplanes around the country were grounded. And ultimately, he saw Air Force One as the one flight contrail left across the United States as it raced back to Washington late that afternoon.
One of the other things that I really had never heard about was the perspective of those that were working at the White House. Could you give people a little bit of a window into what was happening inside the White House on September 11th?
Yeah, and this again sort of gets at the chaos of that day, the fear of that day, in the parts of the story that we don't tell anymore. Because we sort of know how the 9/11 story begins and how it ends, is we sort of forget all of these other aspects that unfolded over the course of that day. And some of the most remarkable experiences of that day happened in the bunker underneath the White House, where Vice President Cheney was raised in the first minutes after the attack. And the sort of odd collection of government officials who ended up in that bunker over the course of the morning and tried to cobble together a response from the government, even as they believed that they themselves were a target, that they believed that Flight 93 was inbound to Washington and thought that the White House might very well be a target. And yet everyone stayed at their post, and the Secret Service in their command center at the White House, one of the supervisors got up and shouted, "After impact, anyone who survives, go to our alternate command post and we'll continue working from there."
Oh my God.
And it's just sort of amazing to me to realize the you know, the pathos of the people as they lived through that day and the experiences that they were going through and the realization that they might never see their families again. And yet, you know, they stayed to do their job. And Vice President Cheney, you know, in that bunker ends up giving the unprecedented order to shoot down any further hijacked airliners. And for a period of time, you know, that morning, they think that they have actually done that, you know, that they actually think incorrectly that they have shot down Flight 93, perhaps other flights as the morning unfolds. And just sort of these incredibly weighty decisions that they are making with no rule book, no idea what happened, and really no idea who has survived, or sort of what the next targets are. I mean, sort of, again, part of what we forget about 9/11 is it really wasn't just the four flights. You know, for much of that morning, the U.S. government thought that there might be as many as a dozen or two dozen hijacked planes, and that these attacks were not going to be limited just New York and DC. But, you know, you saw skyscrapers evacuated in Boston and Los Angeles and Chicago. The Sears Tower, they evacuated because they believed a plane was imminently headed for Chicago. And, you know, even in Toronto, they actually shut the subways down, figuring that the subways might be a target in Toronto. I mean, this was an attack that rippled across the country and across the continent and around the world that day in ways that, again, are sort of hard to capture now because we sort of tell this neat and clean, simple story about what 9/11 was.
I think another interesting sort of thread throughout the book is understanding that human triumph of spirit, even in the darkest of moments. For example, Barbara Olson is on American Flight 77, and she's speaking to her husband, Ted. And while they had moments where they'd say, I love you, most of the conversation, she is, what Ted said, was very calm and giving him lots of information that he could provide to authorities on where the hijackers were located and what was happening on the plane. It always surprises me to this day that there are not more videos of the plane going into the Pentagon or even being in the airspace in DC. Does it surprise you at all?
No, and this sort of gets at one of the other things that's sort of weird to go back and realize and think about is that we consider 9/11 part of our modern world. You know, we think of 9/11 as very much part of our life now. And you know, in some ways, it is the beginning of the modern world. I mean, it's sort of as clear a divider between the 20th century and the 21st century as we have. And yet when you realize the primitive nature of the technology that people actually had at their fingertips then, it's almost more in line with the Stone Age than it is the lives that we have now. And that, the cutting edge technology at the moment were BlackBerries. The digital cameras were just in their infancy and something that really only professional photographers were beginning to use at the time. The White House was relying on some of the most advanced technology that they could have at that time, which were actually two-way pagers, where you, in response to a page, you could send one of 14 pre-programmed responses. And that, like, that was how the White House traveling party actually first learned of 9/11 and began to respond to it, was via pager. And so when you sort of look at that day, you know, the challenges that people had communicating, within the World Trade Center itself, within Washington or New York itself, or across the country, were very, very real. And the options that people had were very limited. I mean, many people did not have cell phones across the country at that time. And at that point, actually, cell phones were overloaded pretty quickly in both New York and Washington and many other major cities. And so they were sort of largely useless anyway.
Very true. I desperately called my sister that day and it took hours before I could reach her. One of the great things too about this book is you bring light to different facts that I don't believe I had ever read about. For example, I had no idea that as far as the Pentagon, the part that was impacted was Wedge 1, which had just been redone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the irony of it being hit. My friend Joe Healy was one of the first responders, and he said it was bizarre how you could be looking at a cubicle that was untouched with photo albums or, you know, pictures on someone's desk, and then you look just a few feet over and it's totally destroyed.
This sort of gets at what to me was one of the most haunting themes of that day as I was researching this book and writing about it is the way that just dumb luck ends up playing such a huge role in who lives and who dies on 9/11. And you look at these incredibly minor decisions that we make 1,000 times a day without any real thought for the alternate universes that we might be unlocking with our choices. You know, when to step out and get a cup of coffee, what train to get on, what bus to get on, when to run an errand. Michael LaMonaco at the, who was the chef at Windows on the World, the restaurant atop the North Tower, he would have been in his kitchen by 8:30 that day. He was in his kitchen every day at 8:30. But that morning, of all mornings, he stopped and got a new pair of glasses at Lens Crafters in the basement of the World Trade Center, and so missed the last elevator to the top of the tower. And more than 70 of his colleagues were killed that day, and he wasn't. And at the Pentagon, the plane happened to hit, and the hijackers didn't know this. The one wedge of the Pentagon, if you sort of think of the Pentagon as five equal wedges, that had been reinforced to the latest blast protections. And it was just finishing a multi-year renovation and was largely empty because people were just starting to move back into it and had been reinforced to a much higher degree of blast worthiness. And so if the plane that day had hit any of the other four wedges, the damage would have been much greater. I mean, thousands of more people would have died. And then, as your friend, the first responder, was saying at the Pentagon, I mean, part of what was so haunting there was just how much, again, these little decisions. Where someone happened to be standing at the moment of impact, determined whether they lived or died. There was one Army conference room that was hit, where after impact, everyone in the room survived, and they came out of the room, and everyone who turned left in the smoke died.
Oh my God.
And everyone who turned right lived. And, they didn't know.
Yeah.
And everyone sort of just made their own little decision in that moment. And, it's those decisions that end up deciding on 9/11 whether someone lives or dies.
Do we have any idea, and I'm not sure if you do, Flight 77, was that meant for the Pentagon, the Capitol, the White House? Was this a last-minute plan to hit the Pentagon, or did they have another idea of what they wanted to do?
Well, we sort of assume that American 77 did hit its intended target at the Pentagon. We still don't know what target Flight 93 ultimately was aiming for. There's a lot of debate about whether it was the White House or the Capitol. I think there's a general consensus that it was likely supposed to be the Capitol, which is just a much larger and easier target to hit from the air than the White House. But again, sort of part of what is so strange about that day is realizing how little we understood about the attacks as they were unfolding. One of the most sort of haunting quotes that I came across in my research was Denise Miller, who was one of the police officers who responded to Flight 93. She was a police sergeant with the Indian Lake Police Department, which is one of the small communities around Shanksville there. And she was one of the first police officers at Shanksville that day at the crash site. And as she is showing up, you know, she really only has four facts that she knows. She knows that two planes have hit the World Trade Center. One train has hit the Pentagon. And that this plane has hit this field in Pennsylvania. And so she talks about how she was standing there in the field, terrified, because she assumed that the terrorists intended to strike that field. She assumed that there was some secret government facility hidden under that field that she didn't know about, and the government and that the terrorists did. Because again, all she knows is they've hit two other incredibly high profile targets. And so why would they have targeted this particular field in Shanksville? And then remember, the other thing she knows is that there were two planes that hit the World Trade Center. And so she's standing there sort of terrified about what the facility is that's buried under the field, looking up in the sky, assuming that there are other hijacked planes that are coming to crash into this field in Pennsylvania to continue to try to target whatever they are that's buried under it. And it's one of those sort of quotes that when you read it with all that we know now, and everything that we now understand about the passengers aboard Flight 93 and their incredible bravery in retaking that plane, it almost seems crazy or laughable to read Denise Miller's account of that day. Yeah. But if all you know is what she knew during the 10 a.m. hour of September 11th, it's actually a very logical conclusion that she's come to. It's those types of moments and sort of those types of human reactions that just really stood out to me throughout this project.
I never fully appreciated just how large the marine evacuation from Lower Manhattan was, how yes. those water taxis, the Coast Guard ships, even private boats, and how it basically rivaled World War II's Dunkirk evacuation in numbers, getting people out of the city. Was that as surprising to you as it was to me?
Yes, it absolutely was. And I think that is, and I'm so glad you raised that, because that was sort of one of the aspects of that day that really stood out for me in the context of things that if they had happened on any other day in modern American history would be among the most dramatic things that have ever happened in modern American history.
Absolutely.
And yet on 9/11 are not even among the 10 or 12 most interesting things that have happened that day. And so you have, as you said, the water evacuation of Lower Manhattan, where this incredible makeshift armada of pleasure boats and luxury yachts and fishing vessels and tugboats and passenger ferries end up evacuating more than 500,000 people from Lower Manhattan with very little coordination. I mean, this was not... Mm-hmm. You know, this really was sort of America's Dunkirk.
Absolutely.
And then, you know, at the same time, you have this incredibly dramatic story playing out of the decision by the FAA and air traffic control to land all of the planes that are in the air aboard the above the United States that day immediately, which again, on any other day would be among the most dramatic things that has ever happened, but that we actually don't really focus on just what a Herculean effort that really was that day. That Ben Sliney, the National Operations Commander for the FAA that morning, was actually in his first day on the job on 9/11 as the National Operations Manager. And he, in his first 90 minutes at work, gives two orders that no American has ever given before or since. Shortly after the second crash, at 9:07, he gives the order to institute a nationwide ground stop, that any plane that has not yet taken off is not going to be allowed to take off. And then around 9:40, after the Pentagon has been hit, he institutes, he gives an order to land everything now. Yeah. And every plane in the sky is going to be forced down at the closest airport, regardless of the plane's destination, and regardless of whether the airport is in any way prepared to receive such incoming traffic. And so you have these sort of incredible scenes playing out across the country as in the first 10 minutes, they put 750 planes on the ground across the country, and ultimately force down all 4,500 planes that are in the air that day.
Unprecedented.
And you know, we are sort of only familiar with the tail end of this story, which is the 38 planes that end up in Gander, Newfoundland, the transatlantic flights that are forced down in Newfoundland, that sort of form the story of Come From Away, the Broadway musical. And yet, you know, that's really just one of many, many such dramatic stories that are unfolding that day.
I love how you brought up how 10 office workers carried their quadriplegic colleague down 69 flights in a specially designed chair. I like that you highlighted how Rick Rescorla, the vice president of security at Morgan Stanley, died in the process of evacuating early and leading survivors to safety. I like that you highlighted Captain Patty Brown's last communication, how it was to refuse a direct order to evacuate because he would not leave his injured men behind. And my most favorite story, which is also in a great book, if you have children, which my kids love, called The Red Bandana, a story about Wells Crowther, who was an American equities trader and volunteer fireman known for saving as many as 18 lives, and in which he lost his own life. Of all the stories that you compiled, my last question is, which one tugs at your heartstrings the most?
Oh, that's a tough question, because in what is sort of my dumbest observation about writing this book, I was really unprepared for how emotional writing a book about 9/11 would actually turn out to be. And I waded through ultimately about 2,000 9/11 stories to whittle down to the 500 or so that are in this book. When I was reading those and going through them, I mean, I was crying, you know, probably every single day over sort of one story or another. I mean, and you touched on some of them, but like these incredible stories of, people reaching out to help their coworkers, the first responders and their sort of incredible bravery of that day. But to me, sort of the most intense and amazing stories were those about families. The parents worried about their children, the siblings worried about a brother or a sister, there are some of those stories that I still can't talk about without crying today, and have sort of like left out of all of my book tour talks because I'm like, I just can't talk about these. What is, and you sort of mentioned this in one of your earlier questions, the incredible strength and resiliency that comes out of that day is also remarkable to me. And the book the book is sad. It is tragic. There is a lot of terrible stuff in it. But I would like to think sort of at the end of the day, there's actually a lot of sort of hope and resilience that comes through in the book too. And sort of the way that people rose to the occasion that day, you know, as Americans, as humans, you know, as friends, as family. And then also, you know, the way that 9/11 remains part of our daily life now, and part of their daily lives now. Will Jimeno, who was a Port Authority police officer, and he was trapped under the rubble of the World Trade Center. He and his Sergeant John McLaughlin are the literal only two people to be rescued from underneath the Twin Towers. And it's just the two of them. They're the only two people who survived underneath the towers. And Will sort of talks about how he knows that he will never beat the PTSD that he got from that experience, you know, that, you know, he knows that, you know, the day that he beats PTSD will be the day that they put him in the ground, is what he says. But what he talks about, and he sort of turned his life into a career of talking to inmates and addicts and school kids, military recruits, about overcoming adversity, because a big part of his message is, look, I had 220 stories of the World Trade Center collapse on top of me. Every one of us at some point in our lives has the World Trade Center collapse on top of us. And it's about sort of how you respond to that moment, and whether it's the death of a family member or the loss of a job or, you know, the end of a relationship or, you know, struggling with addiction or struggling with a health problem, that there's sort of a moment in each of our lives where we are confronted with something that is much worse than anything that we could have ever imagined. And that it's about how we respond as individuals to that moment that defines how our lives unfold.
I agree. I also just like to be reminded of the incredible sacrifice of those that serve in the military, those that, you know, a lot is to be said in our modern era about people who work in government, but you know, it is a big job. It's a big sacrifice, and not all of them are paid well, and they do a really great job. And it's nice to be reminded of that. And I really enjoyed, as sad as it was, to be reminded of the story of those that were on United Flight 93 and how strangers banded together and were determined to fight the hijackers. So I think these stories are important to be remind us of. And so I recommend this book, The Only Plane in the Sky by Garrett Graff. It's an oral history of 9/11, and it really should be put on every bookshelf, in every school library, in every family home, to be reminded. There is a lot of hope in this book, and we should never forget the people that were impacted on this day. And I am so grateful that you wrote this, and I thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Netflix breakout docuseries, Don't Fuck With Cats, Hunting Internet Killer, has absolutely captured the nation's attention. The three-part limited series covers the story of Luca Magnotta. By the way, that's a made-up name that he came up with. And the heinous Canadian murder he was charged for, and which may have never come to light had it not been for two people, John Green and Deanna Thompson. Green is a Los Angeles resident with a penchant for internet sleuthing, and Thompson, a Las Vegas casino data analyst, worked together over the course of 2 years to unearth Magnata's identity after a video of a man killing two kittens in a vacuum-sealed bag went viral. What the two didn't know is how extensive and potentially dangerous their search would be. The two initially met on a Facebook group dedicated to tracking down the original poster of the video, but their search would lead them on an insane chase across three different international hub cities. And even more terrifyingly, Thompson would end up in the potential crosshairs of Magnata before his eventual arrest, receiving at least one video and one threatening quote. Despite not having met until after Magnata's arrest and trial, the two, along with the help of a select number of Facebook group members, always seemed to be one step ahead of the police investigation of the most gruesome murders in modern history. I have asked author and Boston police officer Brian Dunford to review this bizarre yet fascinating series on Netflix. Welcome back to the show.
Kate, thanks for having me back.
Now, had you ever heard about this case before I asked you?
As I finished the docuseries, I remember that I had heard about it because I remember that he had sent the body parts to the political parties in Canada, and I found it absolutely fascinating.
So director Mark Lewis reveals his reason behind making the film. Part of what set the docuseries apart from a traditional true crime documentary is how personal Thompson and Green's chase for Magnata became. After finding several of his online accounts, the duo noticed things that might not be deemed relevant in a criminal investigation, that Magnata had liked trailers of Catch Me If You Can, and that he had a fascination with the film Basic Instinct. What did you find about this case that was so intriguing?
What's fun about this is I knew a lot of the things before I even heard them coming. When I saw that he was using the name Tramell, I said, oh, that's the last name of the bad guy from Basic Instinct, just because I'm kind of a nerdy movie geek myself. But he was so immersed in pop culture and had his, drew his inspiration from the seedy side of pop culture. It was like the dark side of the Kardashians, someone who desperately wants fame and doesn't know how to go about it. I watched that quick scene from his attempt to go on TV when he was on some reality show being a male model. And it was obviously so practiced. It was like someone playing a model on a soap opera and what he thought it should sound like. It was so false, and yet he was totally immersed in it and dedicated to it.
As you're watching it sort of unfold, are you calculating his criminal profile? And if so, how did it look to you? How would you kind of spell out his profile?
I did the same thing, because in the third episode, about 5 minutes before they announced it, I said to myself, doesn't this guy have any other friends or connections to the real world? And then they sort of went into his background a little bit, his childhood. And I'll admit I did a slight bit of research to confirm my suspicions, but there was mental health issues in the house. He was young and bullied at school terribly, his mother said. I think he probably started showing signs of being gay or just non-traditional masculine signs that kids picked up on. And frankly, when you have a kid like this who's ostracized in that position, it's kind of a pedophile's dream come true. So I think at some point he was probably victimized himself. I think it's almost certain based on the crimes he began to commit and things he was doing to animals, which is traditional for serial killers. They first start on animals, that he was victimized himself at some point.
Wow. And what did you think about his way of associating himself with the Carla Homolka case?
Oh, that case is horrifying. He was obsessed with fame. He was a pure narcissist. And those people were too, but he had like a compulsive need to somehow attach himself to greater things, greater evils. It takes a certain degree of narcissism to create 70 Facebook accounts and then talk about yourself online and post pictures of yourself all over the place. That's deeply strange.
Do you think that the animals that he killed in the video, would you assume that was the first time he committed an act on an animal, or would you think that he had been doing that for many years?
I would think he's graduated and slowly started doing things. There's definitely some things in his past that we don't know about and we'll never know about. But most violent criminals escalate, and they don't start with their first murder. They've gotten there slowly.
How serious or not serious do detectives take online groups, citizens, you know, who have done their research on a crime?
For the vast majority of crimes, I would say not particularly. It's not uncommon that you'll find someone who wants to be a detective and be part of the case. I frequently get, when I'm at community groups, some people want to get involved and want to offer their suggestions for how we should approach it. The one difference I would make it would be like child victimization cases, or if you're trying to track down child pornography, something like that. I wouldn't be surprised at all if there were actually some very valuable online sleuths, much like these people, much like Deanna and John Grant.
Do you ever go online looking for a blog or a group when you're investigating a case? Do you use social media to investigate at all within your police department?
Absolutely. I'll look up individuals who I suspect of committing crimes. I've actually found, I hunted a group of guys doing armed robberies throughout in Boston and surrounding towns. And I actually found him posing on Facebook with a picture of the gun he used in the latest armed robbery.
Wow. And is that based on your own research, or do you have people within the department that are savvy in social media who are looking for information on people? And do you think that that's important for a police department to be savvy in understanding social media?
Absolutely. It's intelligence, pure and simple. You have to stay on top of the stuff, and we're not prying into people's lives. They advertise this stuff on social media, and we have a duty to go look at it.
Why do you think that the Canadian police didn't pursue the lead from the Facebook group?
I just would presume they didn't take it seriously. It was probably a thing about killing cats, and they looked at it and said, we're never going to find this guy. And in their defense, it took more than just a little investigation to track him down. This was the obsessive work of 15,000 people. I love the piece about finding the vacuum cleaning group, which is
amazing. That was so cool.
In 2020, did you ever imagine there's a Facebook group talking about vacuum cleaners and they can identify them on the spot? But there are.
I just like, I like that notion that we can all crowdsource, you know?
That if you just try hard enough, you will find the group that's obsessed with your one little tiny problem.
So if an average person finds something online and does research like the group in the documentary, what local agencies can they approach besides the local police department to get the case investigated or taken more seriously? Like, for example, would they have gotten more traction with the local FBI office rather than the local police department?
In this case, because it was so weird, it was a guy killing cats, I really don't think it would have changed anything. You might have caught the attention of one individual, and finding that one individual is just sort of the magic of the internet. You put these things out there, and that one person, that one detective or investigator who would listen and go, wait, there's something to this. I've got to pay attention. And I've seen that, and I've actually seen it save lives.
So do you think that the amount of attention the Facebook groups gave Luca led him to do crimes at a faster pace?
I think they fed one another. Luca was desperately looking for attention.
Right.
And that was probably the function. He was looking for a connection to people, and he wanted to be something in this world, and he wasn't finding it. I'm assuming he was a desperately lonely person,
yeah,
fundamentally unable to connect. And that's what he found in this. He found that these people were obsessed with him, and that fed his own need to become this person. He was on a track to self-destruction anyways.
True. Probably. There was a second set of hands in one video. One journalist has said that it was a female neighbor who confessed that those were her hands, but no further details were ever offered. Did you notice that too?
I noticed it the second time around when it was pointed out. I'm just assuming it was the owner of the python.
Why do you think that they've never been, you know, pulled into an investigation, or we've never found out their name, or they have never been considered an accomplice?
A creature like a python, it's not going to eat python food. It's not going to be something nice and safe. It probably eats mice and rats that you pick up from the store. If you own a creature like that, you're probably going to become accustomed to it very quickly, eating things that you and I as city dwellers would be very uncomfortable with. From that point of view, taking out a cat is probably not that far-fetched. It's not that far a jump. Now, that's not saying it's not unhealthy and not illegal. It's wrong to feed a living cat to a python. But to suggest that there's another psychopath out there working because they fed a cat to a python, I think it's probably just a disturbed person who wanted to chase something a little more extreme.
But you had mentioned that serial killers oftentimes begin by killing animals. So if you are privy to someone online who's a predator or an animal abuser, would that be a red flag for your department? Like, would you go out and meet with this person or monitor it if they're showing behavior where they're killing an animal?
Oh, absolutely. Herding animals is a crime in and of itself. We want to know about it. That's wrong in its own right. And then going another step forward, what's going to happen to this person if this is unaddressed? Because I much like domestic violence, much like anything, these crimes start small and they increase and get more intense.
Altogether, what was the most surprising part of this investigation that you found as an investigator yourself?
Oh, the first two episodes surprised me time after time. How about the part where he went to her work, where he started researching them?
And how was he able to find out where she worked?
Because people leave little trails about themselves all over the place. And just as they found him, if you're patient enough and you start clicking on their links, you will find little telltale signs about people. Who knows what Deanna, and I loved her name, Body Movin', who knows what she had left there about herself, little passing notes, a picture of her, a selfie someplace with Las Vegas in the background. Some people are very clever, and if you're obsessive and spend, as Deanna said, 16 hours a night researching the stuff, it's unbelievable what you can find.
Were you impressed with their ability to look at every single last detail, like the way that Deanna was able to look at the lights and know that they were Canadian street lights?
It knocked my socks off. One part of it that was amazing was she recognized that Luca always skipped the space when he put an apostrophe or a comma or something. It was something like that, a little trick that only someone who was truly obsessed with Luca Magnotta would notice. And she started spotting him doing it in his fake ads on Craigslist and things.
Amazing. So
yes.
What were any of, like, some lasting thoughts on this investigation and this docuseries in terms of looking at it from with a criminal investigation background? What can we take away from it? What makes Luca Magnotta's story so interesting?
Well, I like to tell people at community meetings that, you know, not every crime is solvable. And then you see this one, you go, oh, geez, maybe I'm wrong. The vast majority of crimes out there don't have video leads in an electronic trail. That being said, it's also terrifying what people can find out about you online just through clicks and patience and a little bit of knowledge. None of these guys were computer experts from India who came here to learn the secrets of Silicon Valley. They were regular people who just liked to play on the internet and were unbelievably patient.
How long do you think that this investigation would have gone on if you were to just guess, had they not had the help of these sleuths?
They wouldn't have solved it. To do this kind of work that they did on their own, the FBI will fly hundreds of agents into, like, say, a bombing in Times Square, and they'll assign, you know, a team of agents to each block, and they'll actually be able to, like, capture all the video in reverse, figure out exactly where the suspect came from and track him as far as close to his house as possible. That takes hundreds of agents who are experts at this. These people did it on their own. That's unbelievable.
Don't you think that someone needs to hire them to do other investigations? I kept thinking, God, they could figure out so many different criminal cases by this time.
I like both of them, but I mean this respectfully, neither one of them would pass the psych exam of a law enforcement agency.
Why is that? Now, why is that?
Very intense personalities. John Green became very intense talking about this. He would even get angry and begin swearing. And remember, this is something that happened 10 years ago. Not that you shouldn't be upset about killing cats, but he was still emotionally invested in this. And Deanna said herself that she used this as a tool to fight off depression, and that she was kind of lost in herself when she was doing this. These aren't entirely healthy things, going on the internet for 16 hours and becoming so angry at something you saw someone do that you're going to follow them obsessively for 2 years. I think it's great work they did. I'm not insulting them as people. I'm actually hope they're both healthy and happy. But going on in, online and hunting someone for 2 years is not the signs of a healthy individual.
Interesting. I never thought about it that way. Did you have any trouble watching parts as I did? Like anything that had to do with the animals, I just had to walk away or fast forward.
No. I certainly didn't like it, but I've been to animal abuse cases before and I've seen it firsthand. So I have the ability to separate myself.
I'm sure. You do.
Which is a good thing or a bad thing. We'll find out as life goes on.
Aye. Well, can't thank you enough. I'm glad that you got as excited about it as you did. I was thrilled when you sent me a note and said, I watched the whole thing and loved it. So I am pleased that I didn't make you feel like you wasted your time. I feel like most people that watch this get pretty fired up about it too.
How do you not? It was fascinating. It was great entertainment. It was so much better than the $200 million movies I watched.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, thank you again, Brian. Appreciate your help. And tell everybody where they can get your book.
It's available on Amazon, and I just looked up my sales for the year, and I did so much better than I expected. So I'm riding pretty high right now.
Okay, and the name of the book, and it's on Amazon?
South of Evil. It's a crime thriller set in Texas and Mexico. A couple cops find out where a drug dealer hid his fortune before he was killed, and they sneak into Mexico to try to find it and keep it.
And can we expect this to be made into a movie at any point?
Hollywood's banging down my door as we speak. That's probably my next call I should take.
Awesome. Okay, great. Well, thanks again, Brian.
Kate, always a pleasure.
The amazing Kate Casey.
I want to thank my incredible guests, Garrett Graff and Brian Dunford. And remember, you can learn about the show and talk about the show in this episode in my Facebook group. You go to Facebook and put in Reality Life with Kate Casey in the search button. And if you could go to iTunes and leave me a 5-star review. If you would like to hear a little bit more about my personal experience on 9/11, I do have an episode on my Patreon page. You can go to patreon.com/KateCasey. You can find me on Twitter at Kate Casey, and my Instagram is at Kate Casey CA. And I also just want to say thank you again to all of the members of the military, those that are in positions of government, those that are in the police departments and the fire departments, people that are first responders, people that sacrifice their time away from their families to take care of others, and just remind all of us to just love one another and to look out for each other and that we're all in this together. And lastly, I would just like to say enormous love and gratitude to those that lost loved ones on the flights that were hijacked on September 11th, and my eternal gratitude for being brave enough and kind enough to tell their stories, and may we never forget their legacies.
Listen to the 48 Hours podcast for shocking murder cases and compelling real-life dramas from one of television's most watched true crime shows. Go behind the scenes of each episode with award-winning CBS News correspondents and producers in Postmortem, a weekly deep dive. Listen to 48 Hours wherever you get your podcasts.